Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I am Caroline's daughter, and my mother, Caroline, is with me today.
Yes.
And why don't you introduce our guest, Mom?
Okay, well, we have someone calling from Reykjavik, Iceland. Anyway, yeah. You know, Ron was stationed over there during the Second World War.
Oh, wow.
He was at the Air Force. And they had a base there.
Yeah. Well,
okay, so Kristen is an award-winning novelist, short story writer, poet, and playwright. And her original edition of A Fist or a Heart, which is our book today, won the Icelandic Literary Prize in 2017, as well as the Women's Literature Prize in 2018, and was nominated for the Nordic Council Literature Prize in 2019. The novel took second place for the Icelandic Booksellers Prize and was selected as one of the best novels of 2017 by the Icelandic National Radio. She has published 7 books and had 3 plays staged. Her short fiction has appeared in Best European Fiction 2011. A Fist or a Heart is her first novel to be translated into English, which is very interesting. And so,
and welcome to Writers' Voices, Kristen Eriksdotter.
Thank you very much.
How'd I do on the name?
Yeah, it sounded very nice. Yeah, sounded good.
And of course, that means Eric's daughter.
Yeah, it's yeah, that's exactly what it means. So Eric's daughter is fine, actually.
So, Kristen, tell me, is everyone in Iceland named somebody's son or somebody's daughter?
Yeah. I think this used to be like this in the other Nordic countries as well.
Mm-hmm.
But then, but we are so few here in Iceland, so we don't really need family names.
What is the population of Iceland?
Well, it's 370,000 the last time I checked. Maybe it's a little bit more by now. But yeah, so everyone is. My father's first name is Eiríkur, and so I am his daughter.
What is his last name?
Guðjónsson, because my grandfather's name is Guðjón.
So there
it's
really
the first
aren't
name.
Family names then.
No, and it's actually been banned to. You can't really use a family name. You can't create one and start calling yourself that. Until very recently, until actually just a year ago or something.
Oh, wow.
So and now they're going to permit it, but there's been a law against it. So yeah.
So when Scandinavian people came over to, when they immigrated to the United States, they must have then just started using whatever the person who immigrated, if they were Anderson, then everyone after that became Anderson rather than changing.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that is really kind of cool. So does that mean like pretty much... But there must be a lot of other Eric's daughters because there must be a lot of other men named Eric.
Yeah. It's actually a combination of 2 very common names.
Ah.
So it's a very common name, but what people do a lot in Iceland is it's actually not that common to just have. I mean, a lot of people have middle names.
Okay.
That they use, and that kind of makes the names more special.
More unique, yeah.
Yeah, more unique, yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's never the mother's name.
That's the thing. It's been. I mean, it used to be if the father was unknown, for example, it would be one is Hans, which is it means his, but it's also a name.
Uh-huh.
So that would be a way of, but now it's a lot of people are named after their mothers now.
Oh, I'm glad to hear
that. Yeah, of course, and a lot of people actually have both their parents' names, and that becomes very long. In my instance, it would be Kristín Ingibjargar og Eiríksdóttir.
That would be a lot. That would be a mouthful.
That would be a lot, yeah. Yeah.
Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Kristen.
Thank you.
And you've been writing for quite a while, sounds like.
Yeah.
If you've published seven books and three plays and short fiction, have you been writing professionally like your entire life, adult life?
I'm publishing my eighth book now this fall, but five of them are books of poetry, and it's two novels, a short story collection, and then five books of poetry. So it's poetry has been my, but I studied visual arts. So that's my background, and actually I was kind of working simultaneously with visual arts and poetry for the first years of my career. So it kind of it mixed together, and in my books of poetry there are also drawings, which I don't like to call them illustrations because they're not an accessory to the poems. It's more like one thing. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. And then when I was, and I actually went to Montreal to do my master's in drawing and painting. But then I started writing prose, and I didn't know that I would do that until it started when I was supposed to be studying for my master's. So I dropped out of that. I stopped trying to get my master's and just moved back to Iceland and published my first kind of my short story collection, and then I've been working with prose a lot since then. Yeah. But so I wasn't quite sure for the first 10 years if what I was doing.
Yeah. But now you know.
Yeah, in a way, yeah.
Well,
I like to mix it up also. I work in the theater sometimes.
Mm. Yeah, you have there's one of your characters, of course, is writing a play, has written a play. And and you have some poetry in the book, so it all goes together.
So you're still mixing it up, and you know there wouldn't be anything wrong with having drawings in here either. Could be pretty interesting, especially of some of these props that your main character is making. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, and you know, do you have experience with prop making, or why did this grip you so much, this idea of making these horror props that you kind of centered one of the characters around that?
I'm going to try to answer this without making it too complicated.
Okay.
It's a good question, because it's why I wanted to be in visual arts is that you're kind of you're closer to the material in a way. It's more hands-on, and it's not as it seems like you're more present in a way. You know, you're kind of it's a material world that you're kind of navigating. Whereas in writing, it's more it's subject matter. It's all in your head. You kind of you don't really think about your surroundings that much. You kind of you get into this different dimension. And I think it's a little bit about that, actually. It's about this woman who is very much in the world, you know, in a physical sense, in the world, but she's kind of losing that mm-hmm. that grip that she has had, so she's kind of moving into poetry from sculpture, I guess.
So, and she's losing that grip because of aging.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's not that old. She is, she's, yeah, she's getting some form of dementia. And these are the, these are kind of the earliest stages. And I think that, I mean, dementia has so many different ways of presenting itself. It's kind of in people's psyche. There are so many different ways it kind of happens, and in her case it's not that common actually, but some people have these what we call hallucinations, I suppose. But yeah, people start seeing things that aren't really there, and along with kind of losing some bridges in her memory. So I mean that's but it's happening in a very subtle way.
Yes, it is, because I wasn't, you know, when you're talking about that, I'd have to think, well, I'd have to go back and think about hallucinations, because I didn't enter the book thinking about, you know, the fact that she might not be a reliable witness to her own life at this point. And so I was believing until pretty far in when I realized, oh, okay, that didn't really happen, did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I don't like the word hallucinations. Because I think it all did happen. You know, I don't think she's making anything up, because it's also, I mean, it's her perspective, and I guess her way of perceiving her past is skewed. But she is collecting these events or symbols even in a new way, in a different order, and she's also kind of what stays with her and what is kind of haunting her are the things that maybe she didn't want to pay too much attention to before.
She didn't deal with them. She didn't process them
before. No, so they're kind of, and that's also a part of it, I suppose. It's this physicality that these it has stayed with her physically in her body in a way. And not so much in her cognitive sort of way of perceiving the world, because how I sense her is that she's been a very sort of you know, functional, rational woman until this book kind of picks up. Yeah. And she still is, of course. Yeah. I mean, it's different sides of her.
So, Mom, what was your impression about that? You know, having dealt with your mother, you know, going through that.
Yeah, I know. It was tough. Well, I don't know. I think my mother knew I was someone that she knew, but she didn't know who I was. Mm-hmm. But she knew that this was somebody that she knew in her past, but she didn't know for sure who I was. And that's hard on the family. Very hard on the family, but I understood that's just, you know, the way it was. And of course, all of her brothers and sisters had the same thing. So,
right,
you know.
And of course, earlier, before it was that full blown, when she still knew who we all were, there were events, things that she would say happened, and we're like, that's not how it happened or what happened, or that's not real.
Right.
The one I remember was her thinking that my sister stole her underwear. Do you remember that?
Oh, I don't remember that. The one I remember was that she said that her brother knocked her down. What he did was, they had put up, because she lived next door to the school, they had put up vote here signs in her yard, and she did not give them permission to do that. And so when he came, he said, "Do you want me to knock those down?" She said, "Yes." So he did. Then she told me that he Morris knocked
her down. Oh, wow.
Yeah. She didn't get it straight. So, and I said, "No, there's no way." But, you know, So there were times, yeah, there were times.
So Kristen, do you have personal experience with someone who's gone through this this change in perception?
It's on my father's side. My grandfather had Alzheimer's, and on my mother's side, my grandmother and my mother have had the Alzheimer's or a dementia, and they both died from it.
Mm.
So it's been very close to me.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds okay. And do you think,
yes, and I'm sorry,
is that what inspired you to write this?
I think it did. It's a long story, obviously. Yeah. So my mother, she was born in 42, and she had me quite late. She was 39 when I was born, and she was a very, very good poet and a translator from Russian to Icelandic, and she. Yeah, and she moved to Russia, and when she was 20, and she lived in Moscow, where she studied film directing, and then she moved on and moved to Cuba, and she lived there for another 6 years, and she published her first book of poetry when she was around 30, and she published a few collections, and they're very, very, very good poems. And she, how she earned money was mostly through translating from Russian to Icelandic, and she worked very hard. She translated, I think, most of Dostoevsky's sort of bigger work and Chekhov and Bulgakov, and she worked a lot, and she did a fantastic job of it. So she was a very she relied on her mind a lot in her life, and a very clever woman. And she was quite young when she got ill from dementia. I think Alzheimer is a word that is sort of an umbrella term. There mm-hmm. are so many different forms. She was quite young when she was diagnosed, and we lived together for a while after she got ill, until she was too sick and had to go to a nursery home, and we were very close. So that's a very big influence on this work, and I think that it's been very important for me to make it clear that that there's no character in the book that is based on my mother. They are all based on me, and they're about her illness. Because it's so important to kind of make that distinction between the person and the illness.
Yes, that's a very enlightening point to make, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I started writing it. My mother passed away in November 2016, and I started writing it in December. Mm. So it's written very fast over a very short period of time. And it was published in 2017. So
wow, that's fast. That is fast.
Yeah, things happen fast in Iceland when it comes to literature. It's a Dostoevsky and hasty culture because of our system. We have a very good funding system in Iceland, but it kind of it makes people work fast because you have to produce a lot in order to get funding.
So
it's also it's not very uncommon to work this fast just to make that
okay.
sort of.
So are very point. Many books published in Icelandic?
Yes, there are. I can't remember the statistics, but there are.
So, I mean, with the population of, you said, 370-some thousand?
Yeah, more, yeah.
Everyone must read a lot.
there's a good reading culture, I think. And this has to do as well with the language, because, it's partly because the government is interested in keeping the language alive. So, it's with small languages like Icelandic. Languages are getting extinct every day. So, so there are some like this, for example, writing in Icelandic is encouraged by having a very good funding system. And being an Icelandic writer Icelandic writers are very privileged in that sense, compared to other bigger countries. But I mean, and then again, we write in a secret language, so our books would never sell very much.
Yeah.
So it kind of needs government funding because it's impossible to live off sales unless you write crime fiction.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. I just want to take a little break here and say you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest is Kristin Eriksdotter, author of A Fist or a Heart. So before we get into, Scandinavian crime fiction, which we'll just talk about briefly, but I'd like you to read a little bit from A Fist or a Heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would like to read from not the first. Yeah, here. I met her the day after the boxes were found, which is so typical of this whole story that it all flows together in my mind. Ellen flows up, out of and down into the boxes. Lost, found, stolen cardboard boxes. Not long before, white flies had shown up yet again. I'd already tried all sorts of things. Vinegar, dishwashing, liquid, all that stuff. Separated the plants, sprayed them, dried them out. The flies always came back until at last I gave up and threw the plants out. It was rough. They were all from people I cared about, most of whom were dead. I'm not saying, mind you, that I was devastated or that I'd cried, but it was very trying all the same. A week later, something happened that I also associate with Ellen Alfsdottir and the three boxes. I was messing around with the cords behind the television, an old tube TV connected to an antenna, the old-fashioned way, when I closed my hand around a living thing. In a matter of speaking, cords are, of course, living things. Or anyway, the electricity that travels through them isn't dead. But the thing I was touching was different. It was organic. I was stooped over a dark corner and felt its vital signs and tugged. It was a plant. Not one of the plants I'd thrown out. It was unlike any plant I'd seen before. In the sense that it had no roots, no bottom, a perfectly self-sustaining tangle that drew breath, like some David Attenborough program had taken a shit behind the television. Tillandsia, said the internet, a plant from Central and South America, a rootless plant that lives on air, bright green leaves, long and delicate, that grow in a strangely symmetrical fashion, as if each leaf was trying to envelope the next. like some kind of orgy, and I peered into it, searching for something that might be the beginning or the middle, but I found nothing. Some types grow flowers, I read, and indeed, I saw signs of this on my plant, a minuscule pink bud in one spot. Logical readers might imagine that some friends of mine must have wanted to have a bit of fun and surprise me with this fanciful gift, which gives me the chance to insert something important, namely, I don't have any friends, not a single one. No one's crazy, I mean what I say. There are so many sides to reality that, in the best case scenario, it's cubistic, worst case scenario, predictable, never flat. When I drove to the theater to attend the first table reading, the script sat unread on the passenger seat. The night before, I gotten distracted trying to get the right texture in the clay, and before I knew it, it had gotten so late that it was time to go to bed. The cast had gathered in a meeting room along with the director, set designer, and playwright. The way it usually worked was that they read over the play slowly and carefully, considering the significance of this or that scene. This was one of the dullest things I could think of doing. There were always one or two people in the group who'd latch on to a word and hold it hostage, who'd drone and whisper about anonymous individuals whose names they'd then blurt out. And before you knew it, the discussion would have gotten way off track and be headed still further afield, all depending on how good the director was at their job, that is. Even though I was a little late, I grabbed myself a cup of coffee before strolling into the meeting room. They were all there, the actors with their open, enthusiastic faces, the smartly dressed set designer, the director, all his flaws and affectations completely unchecked, and at the end of the table, the playwright. Ellen looked like she was not yet 20. She sat with her head bowed, her greasy, shiny black hair hiding half her face, and her buttermilk skin immediately catching my attention. I wanted to sit close to her so I could get a better look, and grabbed a folding chair that I more or less crammed in between her and the actors. The director introduced me to the group. Elin will be capturing the father, the bandage heap, he said boorishly and smirked. And the slush machine in the second act, said the set designer, making air quotes and smiling flirtatiously at the playwright. When I'd gotten closer, I realized that her skin wasn't actually the color of buttermilk. Rather, it was the lightest shade of lime green, one shade darker than white, which is why she seemed luminescent. What was, nevertheless, most peculiar about the skin of hers was how thick and supple it was. Her pores were so small as to be invisible. Her skin was so thick that you couldn't see her veins anywhere. Her skin was the exact same pale white lime green all over, like a cheap doll. If I had to make a wax figure of Elin Arnarsdóttir, she'd look artificial. Unlike the rest of her visible hair, Ellen's eyelashes were white, which muted her whole appearance. How odd, I thought. I peered at her scalp to check whether her hair was colored and immediately saw the fresh shadow of hair dye. Two showers would take it out completely, but a few inches of white roots were already on display. She was wearing a white t-shirt that looked dirty, although in all likelihood, it had just been washed so much that it was starting to pill. With the shirt, she'd paired shiny sweatpants that buttoned down the sides, white gym socks with blue and red stripes, and black patent leather shoes, like a vagrant. I'd noticed this trend and was puzzled by it. All these young, attractive people who slouched around in rags that had been bought at some co-op in the 90s and then worn by a goose farmer for years on end, sold at the Red Cross charity shop, and were now recontextualized by youth and beauty. If I dressed like Ellen Arnarsdóttir, I'd be dismissed as a bag lady on sight. I glanced around for a sweater or jacket, but saw nothing that might belong to her except for a crumpled, tacky acrylic sweater over in the corner. Who throws their sweater on the floor during their first meeting in a new workplace? I thought, feeling unexpectedly concerned for the young playwright. I pictured her mother, exhausted, tidying up as she went, always complaining and full of self-pity, while simultaneously neglecting to teach her child how to behave at the most basic level. I wonder how her mother's doing.
That would be a good place to stop. That's, although to be honest, I could listen to you read the whole book.
Oh, mm-hmm. Really? In my accent?
Yeah, I love your accent. And it just, the book sounds, I mean, you get this reading it too, but even more so when it's read out loud and even more so when it's read in your accent, how poetic and how flowing and how full of imagery it is.
Thank you. And I owe that also, I was so lucky with the translator, Larissa Kaiser. She really kind of, I'm really happy with her translation. Because that's not a given that the flow kind of comes across.
Absolutely. Now, Is Icelandic a language that flows like this, or is it more, some languages are more lyrical, some are more guttural, more harsh. What is Icelandic? Like, if you were to read a sentence from this in Icelandic, what would it sound like? Do you have that in front of you?
Yeah. I'm so glad that I don't have to describe it. That's like, it's because it's like looking in the mirror and I can't really. let me read you a sentence. Ég sá fegð á fólki og vissi yfirleitt af því þegar ég kvaddi í síðasta sinn. Reyndar hafði ég líka stundum rangt fyrir mér, en oftast rétt en rangt.
Oh, that sounds pretty great.
Yeah. It does.
It does. I have no idea what you're saying, but it sounds wonderful. Yeah.
Good.
Is Icelandic a very difficult language to learn for foreigners?
I think it is, yeah. It's very gendered, and yeah, I'm not good at talking about grammar and English, actually. It's not my strong suit, but yeah, it's grammatically complicated.
So, Mom, you said that Ron was stationed in Iceland. Do you think, did he learn any Icelandic when he was there?
Well, of course, he was on base most of the time.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
He never told me anything about it, but except that it was a beautiful country, and
This was during World War II. My stepdad was. Would have
okay,
been,
I was yeah. I was curious to know who Ron
yes.
was.
Yeah, and he's since passed away, but So is the base still there?
The base is. No longer here. They moved. But it's only been a few years since they did.
So. Now, are most Icelandic people, do most of them have Danish heritage?
No.
No. Okay.
Icelanders are, the settlers came from Norway. Most of the men came from Norway, but a lot of the women were actually Irish.
Really? Yeah. How'd that happen?
Well, I guess they were Irish. I'm not sure. There are theories. This was a while back.
Okay. Long before your time.
Yeah, but yeah, sure. And Denmark and Iceland, of course. I mean, Iceland was Danish until 1944.
So back to a fist or a heart. You talked about your translator. Now, your English seems flawless, as far as I can tell. Did you ever consider translating yourself?
I do translate, and I translate mostly for theater.
Oh.
And I really enjoy that, doing that.
So why did you not translate this, your book?
I think it's not a good idea to translate from your own language into a second or third language.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think it's almost always the other way around.
Oh, that you're translating from another language into your language.
Okay. Yeah.
So when you translate for theater, you're taking English plays and translating them to Icelandic.
Yeah, exactly.
So is theater a really big deal in Iceland?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we have two big theaters, and then there are some smaller, more independent ones. But yeah, and there are many shows each year. And yes, it's a big thing, and I love it.
So you mentioned, or in your bio it said you had written three plays for theater.
Yeah, I've written three plays. One of them in collaboration with Kari Grettadóttir, and then I've also written a radio play.
Oh,
yeah, that was really interesting. Yeah, I really like trying new forms. I really enjoy that. Yeah, so, and that happened. The radio play happened at a massage parlor. Yeah. So that was interesting too. Yeah.
You mean it was set? The setting was.
Yeah, your setting. Yeah, that's where it kind of happened. But yeah, I mean, but obviously it was floating in the air on the radio.
Yeah. So you have obviously then some experience with the table reading, that you write about.
Yeah.
In theater. And do you personally have the same opinion of it as Aileen did?
No, not really. I enjoy the talk, listening to all the talk.
And have you ever been involved in prop making, or
no? I
special
haven't.
Special effects or whatever it is. Yeah.
No, I haven't. But I did, and when I was doing my research for the book, I went to the theaters, and I also spoke with some people who make props for movies, because it's very different things they do. I found that was extremely interesting. And also what I found out was that, I think there's a description of this in the book, but there was actually this, just recently kind of this thing of kind of pumping blood to stand next to where they're filming and kind of pressing a pump and blood squirts out of, you know, an arm or where, you know, so it's actually that kind of primitive.
Oh,
sometimes. Yeah. So I was talking to these, I think I only spoke to women who were working on props, and they had so many good stories for me. Yeah. And a lot of them I didn't use, but, and also like these, there's these little things like how to kind of thread hair into silicone, and there's this description of it that this woman gave me, that where they take a needle and they saw off the eye of the needle, and that's how they make a small fork, like a very small fork. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And they stick it into a little piece of wood, and they make a kind of fork out of it, and it just seems like this very kind of tiny little aggressive gesture.
And that's how they thread wigs,
putting the hair into the silicone, like making, yeah.
Yeah, which, yeah. Your character's grandmother, that was what she did, and so you described,
yeah,
she, you
described she's a wig,
that in the
wig
book.
Master, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mom, does this remind you at all of the lady from the Black Lagoon?
Oh, gosh.
That was a book that, Kristen, that we did an interview of a few months ago. And it's
okay.
About this woman who was, who created the creature from the Black Lagoon. And,
yeah.
You know, and it reminds me of, or your character in these creatures that she's making.
Yeah.
For movies, remind me of that. And this woman was in, it was in the 40s, I think, and she basically got written out of history because it was a woman, and her boss was jealous of the fact that she was getting all this attention, and so the author, Mallory O'Meara, who also makes horror movies and props for horror movies, got very, very interested in, or costuming for horror movies, got very interested in the history of this woman and wrote a whole book about it. So, yeah.
Oh, I have to read that.
Definitely.
Sounds very, very interesting.
It was really interesting to read. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did your book get published in English? You know, what was the, it's in the United States. So how did that happen for you?
Well, my agent did it for me. I had no, it wasn't my, my doing, but I'm very happy that Amazon Crossing wanted to buy it, because it's not that common actually to be translated into English when writing in a different language. You have so many good books in English that are written in English.
Right. And it's, and it's so competitive here to get published. It's so competitive.
Yeah.
So you must have felt very, almost like you won the lottery.
Yeah, in a way where I guess, you know, like I said before, it's like writing in a secret language, writing in Icelandic. So now also I think I really like that I can send my friends a copy of my books, even if they're not English speaking, but everyone can read English, you know. So it's kind of it opens up into all kinds of languages, having an English version of my work.
I know. I've always felt very fortunate to have been born in an English speaking country, because, you know, it's almost anywhere you go, you can find someone who speaks English, and it just makes getting around in the world so much easier, but it makes us lazy too. Because we
you don't really have to learn any new languages,
exactly. And even if we do learn it, we don't often get a lot of opportunity to speak it, and so then it gets rusty, and we don't get any better. You have to really make an effort,
to be
bilingual.
Do they teach English in the schools in Iceland? Or?
English is obligatory. It's the first language that children learn in school.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, but we learn it from everywhere. I think, you know, the kids learn it from television, from songs, I think.
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Are very many movies made in Iceland?
Not very many, but there are movies made. In Iceland, absolutely, and some very nice ones, especially in the for sure.
So you've done poetry, playwriting, radio play, short stories, novel. Is there any territory in the literary world left to conquer?
I should try to write a film manuscript.
Yep,
I suppose.
That would do it. That would be the one. Yeah. And nonfiction. A memoir.
Oh yeah. I love fiction. I really love fiction. I don't think I would ever write anything nonfiction.
So earlier you mentioned crime fiction as the one type of kind of Icelandic writing that maybe crosses over into English a little more often. Do you have any interest in writing that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I would love to. Yeah.
I'm actually a fan of Scandinavian crime fiction. Joe Nesbø trying to remember who some of the other ones are that I've read. Of course, all the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books, and I just finished watching a TV series that's set in the Arctic called Fortitude. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but it definitely has that. You know, so is Icelandic crime fiction similar to the other Scandinavian countries? And is Iceland considered a Scandinavian country?
Iceland isn't a Scandinavian country because it's a geographical description.
Okay.
Scandinavia is it's the Sweden and Norway and Finland and but it's I think some Icelanders think that we are a Scandinavian country. I think mostly because there's a Björk lyric that where she says, I tried to organize freedom, how Scandinavian of me. That was very confusing of her. But what was the question?
The question was whether Icelandic crime fiction is similar to Scandinavian
crime fiction. Yeah, yes, it is. There's a lot of snow and it's very bleak.
Yeah, that's the word, a lot of bleakness, and it tends to be kind of dark. Now, do you have the really, really long winters and just really short days in the winter and really long days in the summer?
It's very extreme, and I think I was talking about this with someone the other day about nature, about writing about nature, and Iceland is mostly known for its nature because it's the biggest desert in Europe, and the nature is really incredible in Iceland, and a lot of writers write about the nature, and of course, you know, and but then I haven't ever done that. I've never kind of written anything about the mountains or the desert. I was talking about this with someone, and then I realized that I'm always talking about nature in my work. I'm always, the weather is always there. The weather is always there. And it's completely, it's not because I decide to write about the weather, but it's because it's such a big part of my consciousness. Because you might have icy wind before noon, and then it gets really hot in the afternoon, and it just changes so fast. You're never dressed the appropriate way, never ever.
Wow, that's interesting.
So yeah, we have weather. I mean, it's so windy in Iceland. Yeah, and dark and bright.
Maybe that's part of why there's such a reading culture, because especially in the winter, it's, you want to stay indoors by the fire.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You can't go to the movies in this weather. No, that's true. Oh.
So what is your next book? You say you have another one coming out.
Yeah, I have a poetry collection that's coming out now, but I'm working on a novel. I'm kind of in the midst of it. I feel very good. I always feel very good when I'm in the middle of writing stories. It's kind of my
When you start a novel, like when you started A Fist or a Heart, did you know what was going to happen, or do you just start with characters and the story kind of builds from that?
With The Fist or Heart, it was, I knew where it was going, but it was very kind of organic, the way it happened, and I feel like when I write, it feels very organic. It's kind of like this inner compass. So I'm not organizing or kind of writing out the plot line a lot, but I know where it's going, and I'm just following it.
Kristen, would you mind reading on page 142 in the middle of the page? There's the paragraph where the title comes from. Would you mind reading that to us?
No. The entire page or
just the paragraph starting with the change.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I can't find it.
Oh, maybe.
The change. Oh, yeah, 42. Yeah, I was in 41. Okay. Sorry. The change wasn't immediate, not before page 20. And then, all of a sudden, she noticed something in her surroundings, an unusually sharp stillness, or the northern lights over the bay. The attentiveness was new, cut through her apathy, and she kept writing, wrote until there was space, about the size of a fist or a heart, and she breathed differently. The sound was gone, the wheezy, choking sound. There was a slackening at her throat. Her thoughts fired off better in her mind, achieved a beginning and an end. She took out books from the library and read. She wrote, I read on too far, but it's fine. You know where it ends.
Yes.
You can stop it there.
Yeah. And so a fist or a heart, so that is the size of a fist or a heart. That's a wonderful kind of analogy. Why did that jump out to you as to be the title of the book?
I think it's kind of the description of, I mean, she uses it very kind of, haphazardly. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not like, it's not very, thought out when the way I write it, but it's kind of, it's a description of a positive space, kind of. It's kind of like this, positive space.
And when you wrote it, did you say, that's it, that's what I'm going to call this book?
Oh, no, because it's called a different thing in Icelandic.
What is it called in Icelandic, in the English translation of it?
Well, the English translation of it would be Elín, miscellaneous. Elín... miscellaneous. It doesn't really translate. But it sounds very good in Icelandic.
Cool. Very cool.
It's what it says on one of her boxes.
Oh,
on one of the
yes,
boxes she
exactly,
finds.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah. it makes a lot of sense as a title, but it just doesn't sound.
So did you choose the English title or did someone else choose that?
Well, you know, it was kind of back and forth with the translator and but yeah, it stems from me.
Very cool. Well, Kristin, we're out of time and it's been really lovely talking to you all the way from Iceland.
Yeah, likewise. It was very nice to
that's amazing really when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
This comes from a book called Things Everyone Should Know. It's not what happens to you that counts as much as how you respond to what happens to you.
Those are good words of wisdom there.
Yes, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I would like to read your poems, but I can't read Icelandic, so I guess I'll have to wait till they get translated.
Yeah.
So, but thanks for being with us today, Kristin.
Very nice to meet you.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.